Welcome into the Just Above Average podcast. I am your host, Dominic. Welcome to the inaugural episode of the podcast. I will be doing a little bit of introduction about myself, the topics that we will cover, sports and politics, kind of where that comes from, why I'm going to do those two topics. We'll also get into the main topic for the day, which is election 2020. But first, a little bit about me. I am your host, Dominic. I am 5'7", which is just above average for the world population of men and height. The male height average worldwide is 5'6", and being 5'7½", 5'8", that puts me just above average. Why sports and politics for this podcast? Well, those are my two loves. I love sports and I love politics. Let's first jump into the sports side. I am a Tiger, being that I am from Nevada, Missouri. The mascot here is the Tigers. That did not change when I went to the University of Missouri, Mizzou, where we were also the Tigers, so it was natural. I've been a Tiger my whole life. I don't think there was anywhere else I would have gone. I was pretty dead set on Mizzou from day one, so that is what I am, is a Tiger. But life comes at you in some funny ways. When I went back to grad school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I became a Badger. So for the first time in my life, besides being a Tiger, I was also now a Badger. Being a fan of Mizzou and Wisconsin, I have dipped my toes into two Power Five conferences, that being the SEC and the Big Ten, and a third, if you want to count it, since while I was at the University of Missouri, they were still in the Big 12 for the first 2 years. I have experience in living out the college life in three of the major five Power Five conferences. I love college sports, if you couldn't tell, but I'm also a fan of professional sports as well. Kansas City is the closest city to where I live, and lastly, I have been a fan of the Kansas City Royals, Kansas City Chiefs, and Sporting Kansas City in the MLS. Love me some Mahomes, who is also a part owner of the Kansas City Royals now, but the Chiefs kick off the NFL season with the Houston Texans on Thursday night. Excited to look forward to that. I will probably be focused, at least on the professional level, on those three sports, really just the main two of football or college football. I might also jump into some NBA if there's interesting things happening, but I also like to talk the expansions of professional leagues. So we saw the NHL have the Seattle Kraken announced just this summer. I thought it was a super cool name. We'll probably talk a little bit about expansions. Also because the MLS has grown exponentially over the past decade or so. Don Garber there in the MLS has done a great job. And St. Louis has a team, which means there will be some sort of rivalry between Kansas City and St. Louis once again in a sport that is not baseball, where the Cardinals have dominated for the most part. The Royals have gotten their wins here and there, but we'll also talk some fantasy football, where I am in a half a dozen leagues or so. Dynasty, PPR, standard, the whole deal. We'll talk about fantasy football, hopefully, as my teams are doing well, but if not, we'll talk about the other way as well. So that is the sports half of the podcast. We will also have a politics section. I got my master's degree in public policy, so I like to analyze politics and policy from an objective perspective. In that case, I'll try not to let my personal biases come into play, especially as it comes to elections and things like that. But I love the concept of politics. I think it's exciting. I'll probably be focused on the national level elections more so than the state level. That means presidential elections. I love U.S. Senate elections. I'll also probably pick up some spot U.S. House elections here and there if there's some interesting races. At the state level, I will talk some Missouri politics just because I live in the state of Missouri. But there's a few other states that I like to watch and perhaps maybe comment on. Wisconsin being a good example. It's where I went to grad school, so have an ear to the ground there a little bit. But for the most part, sticking to national elections. That is also the main topic for the first episode here. And it is one that I am sure that won't piss anyone off. And that is the presidential election 2020. But first, let's get an ad break before we jump into our main topic for the day. Welcome back to the Just Above Average podcast. I am your host, Dominic. Today's main topic is something that I'm sure won't have anyone pissed off, and that is the presidential election 2020. We're going to have three kind of subtopics here. We're going to talk a little bit about the vice presidential selection for Joe Biden, the convention, a few things that I liked and disliked about both of the conventions, and kind of where I see the race at the moment. So first, let's jump into Joe Biden's selection of Kamala Harris as his running mate. The first rule of any vice presidential selection is do no harm. If you remember, we had Sarah Palin as John McCain's running mate in 2008, and that proved to be disastrous and probably wouldn't have changed the outcome, but definitely dragged down McCain in the election. So do no harm. That is precisely what Kamala Harris does. There were calls by many progressive activists in the run-up to the summer for Joe Biden to select a black woman running mate. I think his selection of Harris mostly quelled that. There's not a whole lot to talk about with Harris because she's not been a senator for very long. Since 2016 was her first election. Her record is pretty much as a law and order. She was the Attorney General of California prior to being elected as senator. So on that aspect, she doesn't have any scandals. She's relatively young. She's in her 50s. She does no harm to the ticket, I don't think. Wasn't my favorite choice for VP for Joe Biden. I think that Amy Klobuchar or Catherine Cortez Masto would have done more, being from competitive states and states that for the future, both the upper Midwest and kind of the Southwest region, I think would have been better choices. And the fact that they've done a lot more in the Senate, but that's kind of beside the point because I think she is perfectly adequate. I think she's an okay selection. I don't think she will change the election, which as far as most VP selections is probably a good thing. She doesn't have a whole long record that can be attacked. The one that is there, she is one of the most liberal senators in the U.S. Senate right now. And that is a Republican failure, in my opinion, to strike on that. I think they've tried to go a more cultural route, and her demeanor just doesn't fit that approach. So in that aspect, I think the Democrats have done really well in their role of Harris as VP or as VP nominee. Not too much to talk about. the fact that she hasn't been a whole big blow-up deal means that it's probably working for the Joe Biden campaign. Mike Pence is officially Donald Trump's VP nominee once again. We know what he's about. He's from Indiana. He's been VP for 4 years. Nothing really suggests that anything else different is going to happen with Mike Pence. There were rumblings earlier in the summer that he might dump Pence for Nikki Haley. That did not end up happening. But there is the one VP debate. We saw in 2012 when Barack Obama kind of blew the first debate against Mitt Romney that Joe Biden got the campaign back on track by kind of crushing Paul Ryan in that first VP debate. So it can have an effect on the race as far as a couple weeks of talking points and things like that. But both of these VPs are not going to move the needle the way a Sarah Palin did negatively, or maybe a LBJ did positively for Kennedy back in the 60s. So not a whole lot to talk about. Let's talk about the conventions. First of their kind in both sides. The Democrats had the unfortunate pleasure of going first in a pandemic COVID world. But I do have to say that they pulled it off. Whoever the organizers and people in charge of the convention were absolutely knocked it out of the park. Very few technical snafus. Most of the programming was geared perfectly for this election. The positives for Democrats, I think, was the fact that they reminded America and progressives, especially, just what Joe Biden's character is. The fact that they had Braden, a kid with a stutter, come out on national television and be able to read a speech in his support of Joe Biden and how he helped him with his stutter, I think absolutely hit everybody in the feels. I think that's one of the takeaways from the convention, in the fact that Joe Biden is just a good guy, reminding people about his son, Beau, who was attorney general in Delaware, how he served in Iraq as a veteran. Also talking about his first wife and newborn daughter who died in a car accident in the months just after his first Senate election, was a sobering reminder of just kind of where Joe Biden comes from when it comes to politics, and why I think he has that personal nature and that that just the ability to empathize with people. So overall, I think hitting home that empathy note. The other thing that I loved about the Democrats' convention that progressives didn't really like was the fact that they included so many Republican endorsers, the main one being John Kasich with the big video there at the crossroads. I think that plays well for the Biden campaign, especially in the fall, and especially in the state of Ohio, which I think will be in play come this fall. A couple of the others didn't really move the needle. Colin Powell wasn't too exciting, but I do think that John Kasich, two-term Republican governor of Ohio, I think that will move the needle a little bit. The things that I hated about the Democratic convention were the celebrity hosts. Nothing says, "We are the party that really connects with people," than celebrity hosts. Are you kidding me? That was absolutely one of the worst decisions made. Celebs didn't add any sort of cachet or anything exciting to the convention that otherwise wouldn't have been there. It just serves as a perfect attack prop for the Republicans. because they already have this, Republicans, this is, already have the message that you don't represent normal people. So for Democrats to trot out four celebs, four straight nights as hosts, really just missed the ball, in my opinion. Another thing that I did like, that I do hope that they keep for the future, and that is the state-by-state roll call. I don't care that they were pre-recorded and that it wasn't live. Those things looked awesome, going to each state individually and getting a little bit of their landscape and people from those states casting those ballots for the nominee. I think that was awesome, something that they should keep in the future. As for the Republican convention, I think the fact that the Democratic convention hit it out of the park kind of raised expectations in some ways, and I don't think they necessarily did quite a good a job. Part of that is not their fault, however, in the fact that there was a hurricane happening, especially in the base states of Louisiana, Mississippi, kind of eastern Texas. Those are the states that were kind of ravaged by a hurricane and kind of takes national media attention away. So you can't fault them too much. The other aspect is the fact that it felt like one of the standard Trump rallies that we've had for the past 3 or 4 years, 5 years, if you count last campaign. It wasn't anything new. We saw a few things the week before the Democratic convention, so I don't think it hit as much. The one big positive out of the Republican convention was, I think, Speaker Tim Scott, the junior senator from the state of South Carolina. I think being the only African-American member of that caucus, I think Scott portrayed a vision of a potential Republican future. I don't know if that is the route that the party takes in the future, but I think it is certainly one that a successful GOP would go down. I think that's the route they should go. If I were a Republican strategist, that is the blueprint right there, the speech by Senator Tim Scott. That's the route that I would go down. Besides that, yeah, not a whole lot. Half the speakers were named Trump. Not much happening. I was not a fan of them using the White House as a campaign tool. I think that is kind of beneath the dignity of the office of president. Shouldn't be used in politics, or not just politics, but campaigns for either side. I don't like it. We're not allowed to have, or the legislators and Congress aren't allowed to make fundraising calls inside the Capitol. I don't think you should be able to campaign and fundraise while in the White House. Just one of those things that didn't really hit me right. So other than that, I mean, both conventions came off relatively without a hitch. There's a few delays that are inevitable, few awkward things here and there of people who weren't necessarily probably ready for the camera being live or whatever. But for the most part, both conventions did their job. I don't think they moved the needle all that much. Out of the two, I would say Joe Biden probably gained more for a few reasons. The first one being the bar had been set so low. Republicans in the weeks leading up have been claiming there's some sort of cognitive decline with Joe Biden. And so when you set the bar that low, it's easy for him to clear it. And so you just gave him a free week of, he just really hit it out of the park, news coverage. And I think that really hurt them in the long run. But the other main takeaway that is a positive for Joe Biden, I think, is the fact that it kind of gave progressives in the mold of Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren a reason to vote for Joe Biden, that reason being character. I think Democrats tried to do that in 2016, but I don't think that people related to Hillary Clinton's character in a way that they can, in a way that they can at least empathize with Joe Biden. I think they're two fundamentally different candidates. Joe Biden, I think, is in a much better position than Hillary Clinton, especially as it relates to the issue of character. Even some of the most staunch Republicans have had great things to say about Joe Biden. Lindsey Graham had a video that was probably from 2014 or 2015 talking about how if you can't respect Joe Biden as a person, then you're probably not a very good person or something like that. I'm paraphrasing. So I think that while many progressive activists are not happy that Joe Biden doesn't support Medicare for all, I think that they will be able to, if you want to say, at least hold their nose and vote for him due to the character issue. And I think Donald Trump being in office was reason enough, but I think it was probably nice to have that little reassurance that the character aspect is a positive. Anyway, so I don't think conventions move the needle. So now we're going to jump into where the race is today. I think this election in 2020 is going to have two possible outcomes. The first being that it is like 2016 and it is razor sharp and the Electoral College will be the only one that matters, as we all know. The other potential future I see is a Joe Biden wipeout. So in 2016, we had a couple third-party candidates that took a pretty considerable portion of the vote, all things considered. There is none of that this time around. It is a yin or yang, black or white, red or blue choice. That or people will or won't vote. So the other future is Biden just blows it out. Just 400-plus electoral votes. I don't necessarily think that's going to be the case. That's what a lot of people throughout the summer have kind of been hoping for, I think, in national media and on the Democratic side. I think the race is going to tighten. I don't think those polls showing Biden up 10 plus in the generic ballot are right. I just think that a lot of people say, man, the election's not even close yet. I don't know who I'm going to vote for, despite probably have me made up their minds. And that's probably that sentiment of, I don't know who I'm going to vote for, is probably more rural areas, places that aren't as activated with politics all the time or activists or protests, things like that. I mean, 2020, 2019, 2018, to some extent as well, was full of activists and protests and things like that. But living in a rural area, we just don't have the level of protests and political events that urban, suburban areas do. We just don't. We had one high school student, I think it was, organized a little rally in a park after the killing of George Floyd this year. But besides that, there just haven't been any political happenings. So as it relates to the polls, I think that's as the people in rural areas start to really tune into the election, I think that's where you're going to see the tightening of the polls come into play. So in a blowout election, I think it's going to be like 400 plus electoral votes. I don't see it really happening, but that is one of the two scenarios. So in the 400 plus electoral votes, I'm talking about for Joe Biden, not for Donald Trump. I mean, just the way the electoral votes are distributed throughout the country, I don't think there's any way that Joe Biden can win less than 200, as opposed to in a terrible scenario for Donald Trump, I think that he can be close to like 100. So I pulled up a map here. In my Joe Biden dominates scenario, this is where I have him like dominating everywhere: Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado. I have him winning Texas and Georgia in this scenario, Florida, Ohio, Iowa, as well as all the typical blue states and the upper Midwest. I have him at 411 electoral votes to Donald Trump's 125. And there's still two votes out there, that being the main second congressional and the Nebraska Omaha district. Maine and Nebraska are the two states where electoral votes are split up by individual congressional districts. So it's possible for each candidate to take at least a vote or two from those two states. I think in that case, Biden's going to win all four from Maine and win one of the Nebraska ones. But that scenario, I think, is probably not going to happen. Maybe a 1 in 10 chance. I think more likely is a large Biden win. And even to some extent, I think there might be a razor-thin margin. So out of the 411, the ones I'm going to flip back in a closer scenario, first being Texas, I think that Texas still is pretty fundamentally red. I just think they don't happen to like Donald Trump all that much. I don't. Because when you look at the U.S. Senate race there, there are there are parts of the state, particularly South and West Texas, that are blue and becoming more blue, suburbs, things like that. But I think as a whole, the state is still red. But they hate Donald Trump. So the other state that I'm going to flip right back right away is Georgia. I think that after reapportionment, so we have the census here in 2020. Everybody should go check out and make sure that they've registered on census.gov or something like that. Make sure you get those forms filled out, because your local funding from the federal government is dependent upon that. So make sure you go fill out your census forms. After the reapportionment in 2022, I think Georgia becomes more of a target for Democrats. But I think for this election, under the current administration down there, Governor Kemp and Secretary of State, I think that it's still red. I mean, in a wipeout, I think Joe Biden wins those two states, but I think for now, both of them still flip red. But that kind of brings me closer to what I think the most likely outcome is. So if I were to average all the simulations or whatever you want to call them together, I think that this is more like what happens, which is closer to 350 electoral votes. That means Biden's winning Ohio, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, Iowa, Arizona. I don't think he sweeps all of those in a scenario like this, but I think it's a lot closer to what realistically will happen. And then, of course, there is the razor-thin margin. And for perhaps the Democratic side, the like nightmare scenario of a 269 to 269 tie, where the election would go to the House of Representatives. I do have questions about that. I'd like to talk to someone who's like a constitutional scholar, because new Congress people are sworn in on January 3rd. I don't know if it would be up to the new Congress or the current Congress to vote on the presidential election from the Electoral College. So that's something to address here in the future, but let's look at the razor-thin margin, which is kind of what we saw in 2016. In this scenario, I'm going to flip back Iowa to the red column. I'm not really sure where Iowa is at the national level right now. Haven't seen much polling. That's something I'm very interested in. There's an awesome Senate race there. Teresa Greenfield is the Democratic candidate trying to unseat Joni Ernst. I had the chance to work with one of Greenfield's communication staff a couple summers ago, Sam Newton, great guy. So I am interested to see what they are like there at the presidential level in Iowa. Another state that I'll flip back to red would be Arizona. Kyrsten Sinema won a narrow victory in 2018 for the Senate over Martha McSally, who was then appointed to the John McCain seat after he passed, after John Kill resigned from it for holding it for a couple years, I think. But Martha McSally is taking on Mark Kelly, the astronaut who has a twin who did the experiment in space. He also married Gabby Giffords, the congresswoman from Arizona who was shot in the head, survived, and is now a gun rights activist, or rather gun control activist, if you will. But he's absolutely raking in cash there in that Senate race. So he's going to, I think he's going to dominate that one at the Senate. But the presidential level, I'm still curious about. Arizona is home to a lot of older people. So we'll see how those, I think COVID has a big impact on those kind of states. So Arizona and Florida, I'm not sure at least where we'll be in 2 months. I don't think anybody is. So let's just say things get better. We find a vaccine. Those retirement communities flip back to Trump, Arizona and Florida, and then Ohio as well, which over the past decade has turned more red. Even Sherrod Brown, who is a very popular senator there in Ohio, kind of squeaked out re-election in 2018. So now we're getting closer to a 290 to 240 election, with Biden holding Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. That's a lot closer to what I think is going to be reality. I think Florida may be a flipper there, but I think that's kind of where we sit today. And of course, a lot of things can change. A lot of things can change. Who would have thought in February of 2020 that the coronavirus would take over our lives? I don't think anybody saw that coming, but for now, that's where the race sits. I think it's going to tighten. And so I don't think those landslide numbers are going to hold for Joe Biden, those plus 10 national ballot, winning every swing state, winning the South. That's not going to happen, I don't think. But feel free to let me know what you think about the 2020 election. I'm more than happy to take comments, suggestions for topics. In the future, going to talk some more sports. We got the Chiefs-Texans on Thursday. We'll also talk more politics, particularly the race for the U.S. Senate. Very excited about those things. There's a lot of good races in the 2020 here for the U.S. Senate. So until next time, this is the Just Above Average podcast with Dominic. We'll see you later.